station, but again, hopefully we can continue that during the networking break. We are going to move into our next panel. Our next panel is focused on how investors assess management, and Peter Kaczynski is going to moderate this panel for us. He's from RA Capital Management.
All right. So in the interest of time, I thought I'll get started with my introductory remarks and some of the slideshow while my fellow panel members make their way up to the stage, get mic'd up. I'll introduce them after some of the opening remarks. So I'm an investor. I am a scientist by training, but I've been an investor my entire career. It makes me an analyst of things, but not an operator, right? So my interaction with CMOs has been more probing from the outside, asking questions, well, can you do this? Can you do that? And, you know, the answers are often quite disappointing as to how constrained by reality CMOs are. So I'm sympathetic. I've been doing this for a while, I think 13 years or so. So I've gotten quite a bit of taste for reality over those years. But I'm still very hopeful and optimistic every time, you know, I see a new company, a new drug, and I still end up erring on the side of expecting things to go faster and be cheaper. So CMOs, I'm sure, will be reining me in for the rest of my career. RA Capital, we practice evidence-based investing in healthcare and life sciences. We think of ourselves as a think tank. We're a think tank that also invests and supports innovative companies. So we spend a lot of our time asking big questions. How will cancer be cured? How can diabetes be prevented or best managed? Will HCV drug costs go up? And then we say, okay, well, which companies are aligned with our view of history? Which companies are going to make that happen? And how can we help those companies? So the think tanky part of this comes first. We've got about 40 people on the team, and that gives us some bandwidth with which to assimilate all of our learnings. Everything that you guys come in and teach us, everything we learn from key opinion leaders that we talk to at conferences or on the phone, we try to make sense of it all in a way that is a little bit more understandable to us anyway, but you know, we find it's also understandable to others, than reams and reams of notes. So let me give you guys a tour of the space of B-cell malignancies and how we think about some of the challenges that are facing companies in this space, what inspires us, and therefore what kind of capabilities a CMO needs to have in order to help a company navigate this landscape strategically. So my contribution to this panel discussion, and by the way, I'd love to have the panel members come up and join. So my contribution to this panel discussion is to emphasize the importance of CMOs thinking strategically. So what do I mean by strategically? So these are the maps that our team puts together. We the Tech Atlas Group is a subdivision of RA Capital that is charged with being the think tank. They don't have to identify investment opportunities. You know, that distracts you from thinking about the big questions. Later, the investment team will look at something like this and figure out, is there a company whose valuation is right and the financing is appropriate that we might want to be investors? So, you know, first you got to identify your unmet needs. And just an example of unmet needs, if we take a look at CLL versus follicular lymphoma, there's a whole lot of detail there, but I'll point you to some numbers that we consider to be relevant. So median age of diagnosis here, 71, and for low-risk patients, survival is already out over 12 years. So most of these patients are going to live to their normal life expectancy. There's not an unmet need there for drugs with more efficacy, at least, you know, not for the vast majority of patients. The high-risk patients, they're the ones that need all the help. Follicular patients, their median age of diagnosis is about 60. So even when you've got a median age of overall survival that's over 10 years, you're still going to get relapses. Those patients still are expecting more life to live. So we try to, you know, understand the various unmet needs and then figure out, all right, well, how are you going to deliver more life to those patients that are looking for more life? Or in the case of patients maybe who are their cancer is already well managed, maybe they want better tolerability. So in B-cell malignancies, you can think of three basic ways of targeting, though really there's only one drug for this particular approach of targeting bone marrow microenvironment. So it comes down to kill the malignant cells or activate the immune system to do it. So let's take a quick little tour of a few drugs that hopefully most of you guys are familiar with. Roche and Biogen have Rituxan. That's a first-gen monoclonal antibody. Goes after a B-cell marker, helps kill the B-cells. And if you zoom out a little bit, you see that in its competitive landscape, other anti-CD20 drugs are glycoengineered, which makes them more potent, mediate a stronger ADCC cell-killing response. So Roche has Gazyva, and here's a company, TG Therapeutics, that has a phase 3 glycoengineered anti-CD20 of its own. So M means marketed, three dots means phase 3, two dots means phase 2. Simple enough symbology. You'll see this pop up a few times. So what else have we got here targeting B cells? Well, you've got ibrutinib, a BTK inhibitor. And Pharmacyclics was just acquired by AbbVie. So now AbbVie and J&J share that drug. And if you zoom out a little bit, you see there's a few others. So these aspire to have a better safety profile, more specificity for BTK, which may or may not be a good thing, depending on exactly how ibrutinib works. And you've got a number of other companies here, like Acerta, Gilead, BeiGene, Principia, Tolero. And then in the category of B-cell receptor pathway inhibitors, it's not just BTK. You've got PI3K-delta, and you've got this drug here, Zytalig, which Gilead has that's on the market. You've got SYK inhibitors. So the maps are structured in a way to give you a sense of which drugs are related to one another, which are therefore potentially competitive with one another, redundant. The success of one drug accrues to the benefit of a group of drugs if they're all similar, right? And here, this is on the other side of the map. In the immuno-oncology side, here's AZ's drug, which actually Celgene just licensed for the use in heme malignancies, an interesting example of indication splitting. So in terms of thinking strategically, we were taught that you don't split indications. Apparently, those rules don't apply anymore. So we now have to rethink the possibility that we might be able to cut deals where we split indications. And interestingly, you see TG Therapeutics here again. By the way, back when we were looking at PI3K delta drugs, there's TG as well. So you'll see that name pop up a few times. So now let's take a look at all these in a framework that we call a solutions matrix. So we're big on this idea of develop a solution, not a drug. And certainly for complex diseases where you're going to want to develop multiple drugs against that disease, like HIV, Hep C, but also B-cell malignancies, you know, solution development is the future, in our opinion. That's going to require greater complexity in the way that you develop your drugs, the way you design your clinical studies. That requires a certain kind of creativity. That's the main point of this whole slide deck. Very weak laser pointer. Okay. Is there another laser pointer here, by the way? I'm going to take a risk here and press. There we go. Not much of a risk. This matrix basically lays out the major companies, Roche, J&J, Gilead, AbbVie, here's TG, and others, and shows you the major categories. So anti-CD20, B-cell receptor inhibitors like BTK, PI3K. Here's the immuno-oncology areas. And you know, we can zoom in. There's marketed Rituxan, marketed Gazyva. There's ibrutinib. AbbVie and J&J have it. Here, Gilead bought Ono's drug. It's in phase one. Zytalig, the PI3K delta drug. And over here, you've got AstraZeneca's, now Celgene's, anti-PD-L1 that's in phase 1/2 trials. So we've done a quick little tour of those drugs that I talked about that work mechanistically in different ways that are complementary to one another. The immuno-oncology side of it is more a hypothetical, but that's what may come. And here's a central message. Each sold separately today. That's the way the conventional model works. And that means that a physician is asked to, basically means that a physician is the guy who's got to actually solve the problem for the patients, order each drug, get prior auth from payers for each drug, combine them in a certain way that may or may not be on label, depending on how they were studied, and the costs pile up. The vulnerabilities, the strategic vulnerabilities for each of these companies is that what if Roche fills its PI3K delta gap here and ends up offering payers a combination? What if Gilead fills its anti-CD20 gap here? In theory, it's possible that Rituxan biosimilars may come to market, but that's a really tough molecule to develop biosimilars to. But if they fill their gaps, then the companies can basically start to compete the way that TGTX is thinking, right? They've got a phase 3 anti-CD20, phase 3 PI3K delta, and they've even got a preclinical anti-PD-L1 and some other molecules. Basically, they're going to think according to the paradigm of solution development, where the regimen is a product, maybe an entire pathway. Imagine how Lilly and diabetes could negotiate with payers for managing the patients through all phases, right? They've got every drug, DPP-4, SGLT-2, you've got a very convenient once-weekly thin needle GLP-1. You've got insulin. I mean, you could have a Lilly plan for diabetes. You could have a TG Therapeutics plan for B-cell malignancies eventually. They are late to the game in each one of these categories, but they are actually the most advanced solution developer in B-cell malignancies. So this is an example of the kind of analysis we did to bring us around to realizing in this space, we'd like to invest in this company. So we did. So the case that I would make, the argument that I would make here is that, and this is COPD, solutions development in COPD, is that solution development requires a solutions-oriented CMO. And I'm just going to flip through a whole bunch of these maps, and this is asthma. Here's breast cancer. I don't expect you guys to read the stuff that's on there. You can't read it, you know. I love personally editing each one of these things and learning about every little node that's on there. What I'm hoping to convey to you guys is complexity. So this is prophylactic vaccines. Well, vaccines are sold oftentimes in panels, right? Well, combining those in the right way, thinking through what would you want to combine with a flu vaccine in order to expand it beyond just flu, you know, maybe norovirus, because that one does have some antigen drift from season to season, right? And therefore, you would want to give it as a seasonal vaccine. Maybe RSV, because it's also a respiratory vaccine, a respiratory infection. You might want to offer patients a respiratory infection vaccine panel rather than just flu. Non-small cell lung cancer, very complex. In every case, you have to have a solutions-oriented CMO. So I'd like to introduce my panel members and encourage them, urge them, challenge them to be specific without the aid of slides. That, you know, as the moderator, I was allowed to have some slides, so it's a huge advantage. You guys have to hopefully paint a picture in words that makes whatever recommendation you want to offer the audience feel real, feel specific. So please use examples. Right? I love learning from examples. I think that the audience might enjoy it too. So you may find my saying, can you be more specific, give an example of that. So I'd like to introduce fellow panel members, Jonathan Baer from Partners Healthcare, David Berry from Flagship, Vikas Goyal from SR1, and Jeffrey Moore from MPH. So we've got two strategic investment firms, Flagship is certainly a preeminent venture capital firm in the Boston area. Partners Healthcare, actually I'm not entirely familiar with the breadth of Partners investment strategy. You can introduce that, Jonathan.
Sure.
And RA Capital is a crossover fund, so we invest in public and private companies. So let me open it up to you guys.
Actually,
and as each one of you speaks for the first time, just give a more detailed introduction of yourself.
Sure. Maybe I'll just take a segue from Peter. So MPH is a venture capital firm funded by a Japanese pharma company, Mitsubishi Tanabe Pharma. We're based in Boston. We invest in therapeutics only in multiple disease areas. I just wanted to make the comment, when we're asked why we need a CMO to speak to investors, I think Peter's a great example of that, where can you imagine having a discussion with Peter's firm, RA, and you're raising a large round of financing and you're thinking of going public without having a really good CMO? I imagine it would be a very short conversation and not very beneficial if you didn't have a good CMO that could actually really relate to the diligence they've done on the area, on the sector. So you really need someone strategic that really knows the space. If anyone thinks that financial investors are, purely numbers driven, looking at, projected revenues and NPVs and things like that, they're going to be sorely mistaken. The field's really changed, where Peter's a great example of this type of, deep scientific rigor in the investment. So that's it, just making a comment. But this is one reason when you're doing an IPO, it's just as rigorous as going in front of Pfizer's, medical review committee and having an asset evaluated.
So how early do you guys invest? And do you come across companies that don't have a CMO, and do you accommodate them?
We invest in preclinical assets and in early clinical asset companies. So if preclinical, it would be primarily a platform technology, and generally they wouldn't have a CMO because they're just trying to work out the bugs of the technology, starting to think about the best clinical indication. If it's a single molecule company, for example, we'd probably want it to be a phase one company, and certainly a CMO on board full time or as a consultant. So there's nothing worse than funding a company that's asking for $40.0 million to do this clinical trial based on no real rigor in clinical trial planning.
So I'm glad you mentioned platform companies. We'll come back to it after everybody's had a chance to make an initial comment. But what is the role of a CMO in a platform company when you have to think about how your, potential drug candidate A, B, C, D, E might fit into any one of five disparate competitive landscapes? So
I'll introduce myself. So I'm John Baer. I started my career in investing, quote unquote, at PureTech here in Boston, which is a very early stage venture group specializing in venture creation. I just joined Partners last year. Partners obviously is the parent umbrella organization that runs 10 hospitals, including Mass General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital, which represent both $1.5 billion a year in research, but also quite a significant amount of intellectual property. So we do have an embedded venture fund that invests solely in companies that have a link to the Partners family, which is a surprisingly large percentage of new startups here in Boston in one way or another. So it is, a very broad representation of early stage and not as early stage venture. So everything from immuno-oncology, so the first exit from the fund was CoStim quite recently, to medical devices and healthcare delivery solutions. So I think we have a very broad perspective. And going back to one of your questions, Peter, we certainly spin out a lot of companies and invest in a lot of companies that don't have a CMO. And I think, going to the title up there on the slide, I think it's how investors assess management. And there needs to be a core set of capabilities represented within the company that sometimes come with a CMO and sometimes are accessed otherwise. So going back to the previous panel, there's a question about hiring an academic for example, into a CMO role, we obviously have, you know, represent large academic medical centers, and while there may not be many academics hired directly into a CMO role, if you're talking about a way an early company can access some of the clinical knowledge and expertise that's necessary to develop a plan or to speak expertly about a positioning and a value proposition for an eventual therapeutic into the market, you know, that's certainly one way we see that expertise access. So I think really, whether you're talking about a CMO and a CEO or any sort of early stage management team, it's really just about building a credibility about your plan, your understanding of the value proposition of the company, having roles and responsibilities.
All right, so this is where I cut in and say, sure. Let's be specific. Have you? What was an example of something that you said, man, this really needs a CMO touch? It's not credible. It's got a gaping hole, and only a CMO can address it.
So I'll give a near-term example. We had actually a medical device company. I see actually more often than not the small molecule drug or biologic drug, the therapeutic companies are more aggressive in accessing clinical expertise. We had a device spin out that was being run by PhD engineers, had a very strong technology background, had a prototype and medical device development plan, a regulatory development plan. But answering those questions of how would doctors and patients perceive this in the market, how would decision-making be made, were the endpoints in the trials designed not just to be convincing to regulators, but convincing to those doctors, patients, and payers and providers. It was an endoscopy company. It was an add-on to an existing platform. I mean, there's a lot of compelling stories around the value proposition in terms of, cost of development, regulatory pathway, a clinical trial plan from a cost of development timeline, recruiting, perspective. But that last piece was really missing, which is really important because you don't want to develop a great product, get it on the market, and have nobody buy it. So that was mitigated to a certain extent to their collaboration with certain academic medical center faculty, clinician and otherwise, but really that piece was missing.
Did you guys invest?
Not yet.
Okay. So that example reminded me of one. I saw a team of engineers came up with an idea for a device that you could wear that would monitor your basically wearable EKG. EKG, I can never remember. EKG, that's the heart, not the brain. Okay. So EKG, and they said, oh, people wear this, and in case they're having an arrhythmia or something like that, it'll notify them and they can go to the ER. And I said, okay, how do you know it's right? The entire presentation fell apart just without one question. How do you know it's right? Figuring out the gold standard for any kind of a diagnostic is a huge challenge, right? I would expect that to be a CMO's job, right? David, first tell us a little bit about your background, but then key piece of advice, actionable advice with the case study, something specific that you can offer the audience.
So thanks, everyone. I'm David Berry. I'm a general partner with Flagship Ventures, been with Flagship for about 10 years, trained as an MD, PhD, MD from Harvard, PhD from MIT. At Flagship, we have about $1.5 billion under management. We do two things. We invest in early stage disruptive innovations, and we found companies based on disruptive innovations. And in this case, as opposed to found, meaning we take someone else's idea and we call it our own, we actually invent our own technologies and have about 170 issued patents at Flagship. When we think about developing technologies, whether it's something that we invest in or whether it's something that we found and build, at the end of the day, when you're dealing with life sciences, as opposed to the other sector we invest in, which is sustainability, it's all driven by the biology at the end of the day. And who understands the biology of disease better than the person who's going to step in either under the title as chief medical officer or someone who has the training to have otherwise been a chief medical officer and perhaps is a CEO or something along those lines in another position? If you don't have biology, you don't have anything. But I'll give you two quick stories, just for whatever it's worth, getting into some of the specifics on two sides of this. So just for whatever it's worth, we had about a year and a half ago a company that we co-founded called 11 Biotherapeutics going down a path to what ultimately became a public offering. And it was a great conversation between the chief medical officer and a public market investor, not of course Peter's fund, Now he's getting a little nervous. No. And basically, it was a very entertaining conversation where the potential investor said to the CMO, "So you are a practicing ophthalmologist, right?" "Yes." "And you left to go work for a dry eye company, right?" "Yes." "Does your wife know?" And of course, you know, it was a little bit silent there. So his wife did know, so there was no secret. And good thing was they were completely supportive. But part of what goes into this for people of the medical persuasion is it is at the core of that biology. You actually have to be truly driven by the biology that you're pursuing and steadfast, dedicated to what you're looking at and have the world's best, frankly, understanding of it. Going along with that, you also have to know deeply what goes into the biology and what doesn't go into the biology. So on another front, we founded a company called Ceres Health. This is a company that is based on the human microbiome. And the interesting component about the human microbiome is, well, it's all over us. So how do you actually think about what disease to target and what indication to target? Now, in some cases, the answer is pretty easy. But in places like the human microbiome, there's a lot of noise and a lot of people making statements and making guesses and things along those lines. And so when we brought in a chief medical officer, which we realized we needed to do reasonably early in the course of this company, it was fundamentally about these questions of how do you think about clinical development, both in the short term and long term? And we recruited someone who could think broadly and fundamentally from a biological standpoint, recognizing that it's not an infectious disease or an inflammatory kind of concept. It's how does the biology relate? How do you think about clinical development? How do the various clinical trials relate to each other? And we've had a great amount of success with that.
Can you elaborate maybe on an example of a couple of candidates who didn't fit the CMO role and why they didn't? And which things did the person you chose ultimately have that where you said, we got to get this person?
Sure. So as we've looked at a range of candidates, our first instinct, because our lead is in infectious disease.
C. diff, right?
Exactly.
In the interest of being really specific.
Right. Recurrent C. diff, to even be more specific.
Perfect.
Twice recurrent. So we decided we'd go look in the environment of C. diff and infectious disease and go see if we could find someone who had a tremendous amount of experience in that space. And what was great was we talked to a bunch of people who had very, very specific ideas about how to develop small molecules as a way to treat rip-roaring C. diff as a replacement for vancomycin. And the reality is we were trying to change the clinical paradigm. If you think in the existence of only what the clinical paradigm is and try to evolve it, you have a hard time of actually being able to get there. So the characteristics of the classic infectious disease doc was a bit challenging for us. At the same time, we also looked in the exact opposite direction of what if we took a gastroenterologist or an inflammatory person? I mean the disease area, not the personality. And we realized that, wait a second, then they didn't actually have an understanding of how the current disease that we were looking at was going to work. And so what we realized that was going to work was someone who's actually crossed a handful of areas over time. So in this case, you know, as we thought about it, we looked for someone who perhaps trained in GI but got sucked into infectious disease. And as what we ultimately found was someone who'd spent some time across a couple of disciplines, training in one area, developing drugs in another area, and that gave them the horsepower to think about what we needed in this kind of platform technology.
So as an investor in this company, let me add my own little anecdote to that. After we made the investment, one of the things that gnawed at me was that the way that the product works is that after you use antibiotics to knock down the C. diff, you take these pills as an alternative to a fecal transplant, essentially, right? Like maybe you guys have heard about fecal transplants and they can restore, you know, a healthy gut microbiome and prevent C. diff from coming back and recolonizing that niche in the ecosystem. And Ceres was basically offering you a pill that would do that with a mixture of microbes. And I thought, but you'll always be dependent on that initial antibiotic knockdown. Is there some way that you could integrate, you know, so that you could basically give this right from the start? And we were familiar with companies working in the phage space. Well, phage are the viruses of bacteria. What if you could incorporate phage in with the microbiome restoration product that Ceres had? and have something that both handles the knockdown of the C. diff itself as well as repopulating the gut. And so we made an introduction and encouraged that discussion, and I have no idea where it went. Public company, so you know we're limited in what we can hear about. But I'm hopeful that Ceres is thinking about how do we move upstream to treating it right at the start with our product so that we handle both the knockdown and prevention of recurrence. So is that something that a CMO needs to think about? Absolutely, right? Does it involve learning about phage and figuring out whether or not that's a modality that might work? Yes. So that's what I would hope that the CMO is comfortable doing. Vikas?
Hi, I'm Vikas. I'm a principal at SR1. We're GSK's corporate venture unit. We invest in early stage biotech companies. So virtually all of our investments are discovery or preclinical, early preclinical when we first get involved with companies. And they rarely have a CMO involved at the time. So we're often recruiting for that kind of person. You know, the CMO is more than just the leader of the medical development of the products that the company is developing. They're one of the two or three or four members of the core leadership team. And that's a huge burden, right? So frankly, there's very little distinction in ownership in the company, compensation, accountability between the CEO, the CMO, and the CSO. They're all in it together. And so in addition to having that expertise around medical development, we also expect them to go talk to investors. And we've had some very, very high quality medical thinkers who could build great clinical advisory boards and work through really challenging protocols and get sites on board, but they couldn't present anything. They were just awful presenters. You couldn't put them in front of investors. And thankfully, that individual decided to make room for a new hire, and they took on a medical director role. But that was a really tough decision for that individual, and they could have easily left the company. It would have been very hard for us. We have other situations where nobody has ever run a clinical trial in this indication ever before. And maybe there was some academic work done with a drug that had very little biological relevance, so you have no idea how to interpret what happened in that study. So how do you design a clinical trial where there's no precedent and there's no standard of care that you can relate in the literature to the FDA or to the EMA? How do you think through what your placebo group is going to look like?
Is this an orphan disease?
It's not. It's just a really nasty acute care indication where the standard of care is just make sure they don't die and deal with all of the side effects that happen after they get the initial injury.
And that happens to more than 200,000 patients?
It does, yeah.
Okay. That sounds scary.
It is very scary, yeah. I mean, nobody's ever run a clinical trial because, frankly, no drug has ever approached that disease before. So, these are the kinds of challenges that we expect them to be experts in. Because at the end of the day, as Peter pointed out, it is about solution development. But on top of that, you have to be part of that core team, which can set the culture, can talk about the vision, can inspire employees, can fire bad employees. It's not enough that you can...
Let me pull on a string. When you're pushing the limits on something that has never been done before, yeah. And the CMO says, you can't do that, has that ever happened to you?
Sure, yeah. I mean, they know more about it than I do as an investor,
so,
yeah.
How do you know they're right and not just wussing out?
Well, the first question in response to that statement is why? And if the response is, well, that's not ethical because that's not the right way to treat patients, then that's a pretty good answer,
okay.
Right? If the response is, well, somebody has tried that before and this was the result and I don't want to recreate their mistake, that's a good answer, right? It depends why you can't do that.
And has a discussion ever ensued with other members of the team, maybe the CEO, CSO, investors, whatever, board members, where the CMO then said, oh, that's an interesting idea. That might be possible.
Thankfully, that's never happened in a board meeting, which would be really bad if that happened in a board meeting.
You know, it depends on board meetings, but I don't think board meetings need to be too formal. But yeah, hopefully you've brainstormed that before.
Right.
But has that happened where the CMO then said, oh, that is a good idea? And let me cut to the chase. How do you feel about a CMO who didn't originate the creative idea for how to run a trial with the control arm when investigators are telling you, oh, you can't do controls, that's unethical?
Sure. Well, so I mean, the more common example is when we hire a CMO who inherits a trial in process, which happens many times in our portfolio companies because we start with a really good medical director who comes up with the protocol and brings all the investigators together. They don't cut it anymore when we layer on new responsibilities and we need to hire a new CMO. And so they are inheriting not just an idea, they're inheriting a trial in process. And you know, at that point in time, we've had some protocol changes, which has been for the benefit of the trial, but it's, you know, a challenge. It's often challenging for the team that's in place because you've already spent a lot of resources on a protocol and a trial, and now you've brought in a very expert leader who's saying you got to make some changes here, otherwise this whole trial will be a waste, right? So that does create challenges, but that's the whole reason why we bring those individuals in. There's other cases where, you know, they've never thought of this kind of design before, but there was a director who'd come up with something that made a lot of sense, and the investigator community is very supportive. And, you know, this was like the coolest thing a CMO has ever seen, because it was so much more innovative than what they were doing in their big pharma company.
This gets to open-mindedness, right?
Yeah.
So ideally, I think a CMO should have all the answers. That would be awesome. But barring having all the answers, having an open mind and accepting ideas from others and exploring them truly thoroughly to figure out whether or not they might work, to do the control arm when somebody else tells you, no, you can't do it, that's not how it's done. Except investors don't really like data without control arms. That's the reality, and small companies need to get financing, so if that's what it's going to take to prove to investors that your effect is real, find a way to get a control arm. And if you absolutely can't, fine, live with it and take the risk that you may not be able to raise money on your data. But don't just accept no for an answer from the start. So in terms of must have, I think, open-mindedness, can you guys maybe each one go through an example of some phrase, some comment that you've heard from a CMO, in a particular example, where you thought, God, that's toxic. Like, it scares me at this company as a CMO who says this.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time thinking about new investments in diabetes where we see huge unmet need, but it's a very hard area to invest in. And there was a company that presented to us with essentially an insulin sensitizer, and it was moderately novel mechanism, and they were lucky to have a CMO involved who had a lot of experience. You know, her resume was very impressive. And during one of the diligence calls, we asked her, how would you differentiate this product? And she didn't have an answer. And that's like a non-starter, right? And you know, we were proposing things, and frankly, we were in no position to have good ideas about how you develop a drug in diabetes, right? So we were asking, like, well, could you go after, glucose control overnight? Could you go after some kind of longer-term dose exposure because the mechanism didn't need to be dosed daily? And there was just like little to no engagement on these ideas. So that was the other non-starter, is just engagement. And even if I'm asking a stupid question, which again, as a novice in a field, I'm often asking stupid questions, there has to have been at least that question thought about already by that CMO.
And that reflects on the whole management team, I think. That's pretty fundamental. John?
You know, I think the differentiation between a good CMO or somebody in that role versus a medical director or a clinical ops person is the ability to talk about, you know, the concepts that matter to the investors, right? Where did you, how are the decisions you're making or the plans you're setting forth adding value versus, or mitigating risk? Because if it's not doing one of those two things and you're talking about, you know, a risk-reward trade-off that the investors are making, then it's really, it's not being helpful, and maybe you're just designing, you know, maybe it's a different type of role. And I think the most frustrating thing I've ever heard from somebody in a CMO role was they said, okay, the trial failed. I said, well, it may have missed its endpoint, but, you know, 30 minutes into the presentation, you saw actually it proved the biology you were hoping to prove, right? And those are, if you switch the order of the presentation, right, and started out by saying, you know, we actually proved the biology we set out to prove, and then 30 minutes later, the punchline is, yeah, but we missed the primary endpoint. That's a very different story to tell
your investors. I wonder if that's the difference between a CSO giving the presentation and a CMO giving the presentation. But I agree with you. A trial doesn't fail unless it was improperly designed and doesn't answer the question.
So I'll just chime in and say I think we've been pretty lucky. The CMOs we've had, including Seth Hetherington, who spoke yesterday, I think are good professional, strategic, and you know, scientifically excellent CMOs. So we haven't had any of those toxic responses. I think the only CMO type question that we've not been happy with the response to it is when it's been answered by someone who's not actually a CMO, who thinks it's easy to be a CMO, and they're taking on that role. In an early stage company, so and that's where you get the response, like of something failed or the FDA is against
us. Do you have a soundbite, a phrase to add to the list?
No, that's fine.
No, okay, David.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Every job, every senior management job, has a trump card that they can play. So if you're a CEO and your board is saying, "Oh, why don't you do X, Y, and Z?" and then they say, "I can't raise money around that." Well, no one can do anything. For a CSO, you said, "I can't get that done." Right? What is it for a CMO? That's unethical. So if you look, probably about 70% of the time when someone says something's unethical, what they're saying is unethical is standard of care. So you have patients who are untreated right now, and you want to do a control arm, and your control arm is going to be untreated, which implies de facto that your drug works and it's better. But you haven't tested it, so you don't know. But yet, doing what doctors do every single day for the vast majority of patients is unethical. So it's the trump card, because what is a board member supposed to say when you say it's unethical? So it's not to try to pick on that phrase, but it is a particular phrase that's kind of interesting.
Thank you, by the way, for bringing that up. That's a really great point. I hate unethical. Like there's so much more behind it. But anyway, keep going.
Yeah, but that's exactly what it is that, you know, what we're all looking to do is figure out how to help patients. You know, that I propose an alternative for a trial design is not meant to undermine someone else's ethics. Frankly, I'm not trying to be unethical. So I'm just trying to engage in a conversation. And that's why that feels like it's just playing the trump card and saying, let's stop the conversation. It's my way.
Yeah. So we've got 2 minutes, and I want to come back to the question of platform. So David, I'll open that up for you. Moderna, right? The ultimate platform technology that could have tons of different applications. This is injecting mRNA into people, various organs or whatever, and expressing the protein of interest in there. The applications are just staggering. You could use it for vaccination, just intradermal injection. You could inject nucleases so that they're mRNA encoding nucleases so that they're only transiently expressed, and edit whatever DNA you want edited and don't linger, as opposed to AAV delivery of nucleases, and therefore long-lasting expression of these nucleases, potentially chewing away your DNA. Lots to do with Moderna. How do you find a CMO that's going to help you triage all those different applications, or do you need an entire team of CMOs? I mean, it's a well-funded company.
They've done a very good job of raising money, and just building on what you said, their prospect is basically it allows you to make your own drugs, basically for the first time. It's a really cool concept. But the beauty of something like that, where you have this generalized platform, is you can make a lot of candidates. And when you have a broad platform and a lot of money, you do. And Stéphane Bancel, the CEO, had said at J.P. Morgan that at that time they had about 45 programs in development, which is not normal for private or early stage companies, if you will. I don't know if they're called early stage anymore. I guess where they are. But you know, the CMO question is one that we've thought pretty heavily about. One, I'd say. The company was pretty sophisticated in getting a number of MDs into the company, and I guess in an audience of MDs and CMOs, that's a good thing. If we talk to people behind MDs' backs, they probably are saying it's a really irritating idea. No, but we have looked very hard. We have thought very hard about the CMO issue, and the good news is there are people who think broadly about therapeutic areas, and they work in big pharma. I mean, they have to make decisions of how do I advance this cholesterol drug versus this cancer drug versus this rheumatoid arthritis drug. And you have to get deep into the biology. So people who have that kind of experience are the right sorts of fits for a place like Moderna. Now there's a catch to that, which is what happens in big pharma, is they have a bunch of people underneath them who are the super deep experts. Now, Moderna has the beauty of having an early stage culture, but a late stage development problem. And it's a good problem to have, frankly. And they don't want to overstaff, so you need someone who can be both creative and broad and deep at the same time, which gets into this notion of someone who's entrepreneurial and big pharma, which, I mean, how many people are that? It's probably...
So do they exist?
They do, but there's very, very few of them.
Okay. It would be awesome if somehow the industry could generate more. I'm not sure what the process for that is, but certainly conferences like this that bring us together to talk about these kinds of needs, I think, help. We've run over, but let's take a question anyway, because nobody's throwing us off the stage.
Question for you. On one of the bullet points, it talks about communication. And I want to remind you, your phrase when you're looking at the pointer, you may not remember this, but you said, I'm going to take a bit of a risk here. And then you got some advice, and you hit the button, and they said, not much of a risk. The question is this. When it, this is...
Yeah, that was profound.
Maybe this will be profound. This gentleman said something about unethical. And so my question is this. If you think about there's a figurative conference table here and the conversations that we have with you guys, there's a little bit of unlearning that we have to do to be able to best optimally communicate with you. And so your mindset's geared to think about, I'm going to take a bit of a risk here. You probably don't even think about it. But you think about taking risks every day, driving home and all that stuff. Out here, they think about doing ethical. It's the training that's happened. So how best can myself and my CMO come to you and communicate knowing the way you think and tailoring the way that we think to balance it? Like I said, it was a bit of a risk question, but I just wanted to see what your thoughts were.
Well, to be clear, none of us are advocating skipping dose escalation, for example, and establishing that a drug is safe in patients. So none of what we said should be taken out of context. But one of you guys jump in and take that.
I'll just say all the trials we do have control arms, but that might just be the luck of our portfolio. But you know,
try more cancer.
Yeah, we don't do cancer companies.
There you have it.
Well, risk is risk is an interesting word. So when we start out a company, there's kind of infinite risk because there's the question of, does the biology work? Can you recruit people? Can you raise money? I mean, you're about six questions down before you say, does the clinical trial work? And not to say it's in that priority, but the notion of what risk is has all sorts of different relative values. So when we think about it, we're never looking at a trial and saying the question of, is that too risky? You know, we're never trying to put patients at risk. There's never, ever a goal in that. But the way we look at things is, if one lays out the biology, lays out the biological problems, lays out the pros and cons of a strategy, it's actually quite an easy way to have an open discussion about it. Because our philosophy is we want to work very closely with our entrepreneurs and come up with a solution, because we share a common goal of delivering cures to patients. What the difference is our questions come up from the basis of not living it every day. We're trying to understand what you guys know. We know we don't know the details of what you know, and try to engage in a meaningful dialogue that helps us see if perhaps there's something, by virtue that we don't live it every day, we can provide as an insight.
But we see 1,000 case studies, right? We've seen things you guys haven't seen. We've seen somebody do something when you say it's not possible. Now, it means that either they're a criminal and have just violated some sort of like code of ethics in what they did, or you're not thinking out of the box enough. So that's where the tension's coming from, and we can be specific in the cases we offer. It's not just, well, you know, why can't you go straight to your effective dose? You know, you might say, well, what makes you think we can? Have you seen somebody do it? Feel free to ask that question, and you'll learn, hopefully, about more than one company that's done something. And then you might be able to explain, well, here's why it's different. See, AAV, you only get to dose once, and so the FDA is on board with the idea that if a patient's going to take that risk, that, you know, it should have a good chance of efficacy, whereas small molecule drugs, there's no harm in dose escalating. So, yeah, we're going to start with ineffective doses. And now you're teaching the investor and explaining why they can't learn from, you know, one case study and extrapolate to everybody else. But we're generally not making stuff up completely de novo. It's because we've seen something that gave us an idea, and we're trying to apply it more broadly. So thank you very much. This was a great opportunity for us to connect with you guys. Thank you to my fellow panelists. Thank you for joining us.